So some Rashi's from Parshas Veschanan for Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av, we read, not coincidentally, we read Parshas Veschanan, which is always the Parsha after Tisha B'Av. We read a section of Veschanan that speaks about very morose, very pessimistic, Moshe predicts our downfall, predicts our betrayal. I'll talk about a few Rashi's. Obviously, we read the Parsha, we read this section. This section doesn't speak about Tisha B'Av per se, doesn't speak about the Korban Beis HaMikdash, doesn't speak about Avelos, but it talks about the deterioration of the Jewish people in history, our failures, some of the repercussions of Galus. So obviously the Rashi's themselves help us tap into the overarching Tisha B'Av spirit. So one interesting Rashi is, again, this is, if you want to open the Chumash, it's in Perek Dalet Pasuk Chafei. So the punishment is, we'll start with Pasuk Chav Zayin. Ve'fitz Hashem Eluk Hashem Eschem Ba'amim. This is not two pesukim later. Hashem will scatter you. V'nishartem Mesei Misbar Ba'goyim. Asher Yinaheg Hashem Eschem Sha'as. You'll be scattered. You'll be the minority. Hashem will lead you there. Va'avaditem Sham Elukim Mas Elohim. You'll worship other idols. Masei De Adam. Human crafted. Inanimate objects. Now, the interesting part about this pasuk is, it's just not true. What I mean it's not true is as follows. Our experience in Galus is checkered. And you can't say that every single Jew made it through Galus with their religious observance intact, with their faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu intact. But one thing is clear. We rarely buckled to Avodah Zarah. Now, there were, obviously, there was always attenuation of our ranks and defections. And of course, the sad stories of forced conversions, in particular in Christian lands, or people who were forced by just the calculus of their situation and watching other religions rise and Judaism deteriorate. But by and large, if you're looking for the banner that we held strong and that we raised high, it's the banner of monotheism. We refused to fall to paganism. Most of the early Christians were not Jewish defectors, but were Greeks who had been Judaicized a little bit, and they already had monotheistic leanings in Christianity, preached to them and spoke to their hearts. So what does Moshe mean? And Rashi doesn't ask the question, but I think he senses the question. So Rashi quotes the Targum. Targum says, "V'tiflachon tamon la'amamaya polche tavosa," that you won't worship the gods themselves, the idols themselves, the pagans themselves. You'll worship people who worship them. Rashi, "Kitargumo mishatem ovdim li'ovdehem," since you worship those who worship these idols, "kiyuatem ovdim lehem." It's like you worship the idols themselves. Now that just makes the question more intriguing. What does it mean we worship the worshiper? No one worshipped Gentiles. We didn't bow down to Gentiles. We didn't bow down to people who worshipped idols. It's not the transitive law of idolatry that if we worship X and X worships Y, it's like we're worshipping Y. What I think Rashi is referring to is what we call cultural seepage and cultural influence and cultural infiltration. That when you live in an environment of paganism, of other religions, as much as we try to culturally insulate ourselves, we obviously theologically insulate ourselves, we don't worship other religions and other gods, and we try to culturally insulate ourselves from our surrounding environments and cultures, but it seeps in. There's always a backwash. And when we worship the worshippers of Avodah Zarah, we don't worship them in a ritual or a theological or a ceremonial sense, but we're always emotionally, culturally influenced by them. We look to our hosts for cultural leads. And that's always the challenge of Jewish survival in Galus. On the one hand, we want to be part of society. On the other hand, we have to protect our insularity, not to be influenced by the surrounding culture. And that surrounding culture may feel like it's just culture, but in the end, the culture is always, especially in religious society, maybe not in the modern era, is always influenced by religion. and it's hard to separate. We live in the era of the separation of church and state and the judicial system. That's why the Chazal, in fact, it's an issue in the Torah to enter at least in those days, a Gentile courthouse, because the whole judicial system was wrapped up and intertwined with theology and with God, and they had pictures of gods and pictures of idols. And today, not today, it's just a secular, sectarian body of the government to reach adjudication and to reach verdicts. So what Rashi's saying is you're not going to worship Avodah Zarah. And of course, it doesn't mean you're going to worship people who worship Avodah Zarah. You bow down to a Christian, you bow down to a Muslim. But in your inferior status, in Gullus, that's what Gullus is. Inferior status because you're the guest, and in Christian lands they killed us, and in Muslim lands they allowed us to live as second-class citizens paying high taxes through their noses, dhimmis. D-H-I-M-M-I, if you're Dima Dimis, if you're not familiar with the term, official institutionalized second-class status. At some point, you're going to be influenced. You're going to look up to the hosts. You're going to look up to the people who are wealthy. You're going to look up to the people in power. You're going to want to try to find favor in their eyes. And you'll be acculturated by them and into their culture, and then that's where it's going to start to seep. In Avos Driven Asan, which is effectively an elaboration of Pirkei Avos, there's a line that Jews in Chutz Laaretz are Ovde Avodah Zarah B'Tahara. And what does it mean, Ovde Avodah Zarah B'Tahara? Again, our record doesn't reflect that. We were not Ovde Avodah Zarah by and large. But what we were is, we did become sometimes too embedded in the culture. And to the degree that the cultures were influenced by paganism and idolatry and other gods and other religions, it seeped into our own mind, into our own consciousness. We are Ovdei Avodah Zarah B'Tahara. We worship, but not through the horrible, reeking ceremonies of bowing down and black magic and human sacrifice. None of that ever affected us. But there was a filter. The filter was called the general culture, which takes aspects of religion and theology and infuses them into the culture. And then when we become part of the culture, it seeps into our imagination. Give you two examples. One, a well-known example, and one, a funny story. I don't know if it ever happened, but it's a cute story. How many Jews believe that the Eitz Hadas was an apple? Most people would say yes. It turns out that Chazal have many options for what the Eitz Hadas was, but none of them say it was an apple. It was grapes, it was a fig tree, it was wheat, whatever, esrog. That's a Christian concept. But, and again, it seems like a harmless concept. I mean, it's wrong. Nothing that's intellectually dishonest is ever harmless, but it's not going to radically change our theology or our belief. But all of a sudden, these ideas just start to seep in. How many people listening to this view the Satan as a large fork carrying devil with a big tail and furrowed eyebrows rebelling against Hashem? And that's a Christian notion, fallen angels, rebellious angels. Einon milvada. There are no beings on this planet with a will of their own other than us. And every day the Satan wakes up in Shemayim with all the other Malachi Hashareis and says Shira, just as we chronicle it, the Chulim Mekablim Aleim, O Malchus Shemayim. And then after praising Hashem as an extension of Hashem's will, he goes off to make us weak and to make us lazy and to make us distracted, because Hashem wants our freedom of choice to be real. And for it to be real, we have to be challenged. And he does this as a servant of Hashem, not a recalcitrant insurrectionist angel who was thrown out of heaven. But we just take these things and it starts to seep. And that is a theologically troubling concept when you think about it, because there are no angels that have wills of their own, because Einon Milvado. So I heard a story, which is too good to be true, but maybe it happened. Maybe someone listening to this can track it down. Long time ago, a rabbi wanted to shock his audience about cultural seepage. So he got up and he began his sermon on Shabbos by holding up his middle finger, much to the horror of the audience, who thought that he was that aggressive, curse-like, verbal assault. And after all the hooting and gaping died down, he said, "I hold up the holiest finger for a Jew, which is the finger around which I wrapped tefillin, and this is how you respond. Look how far you've fallen. Look how much Christian or general culture has seeped into your conscience." And he gave him a Musar Shmos. Now, the afterword of that bit of a joke is the next day he was fired. But the joke is he wasn't fired for holding up his middle finger. He was fired
for giving mussar. Who do you think you are? You're the rabbi. You're supposed to talk about politics and Israel. Say something nice about the bat mitzvah and the newly married couple. Announce the sisterhood meetings for the coming week. You're not supposed to get in our face and challenge us morally. Like, that's not the job of a rabbi. You're malpractice. It's a dysfunction. You're not supposed to give us mussar. Anyway, it's a really interesting Rashi and really interesting to superimpose it onto our galus. Okay. Next interesting Rashi. Moshe Rabbeinu was pleading with the Jewish people, and he's trying to prove to them how privileged they were, what they saw, what they were exposed to. And he rifles off a series of three psukim, actually two psukim, and in these three psukim, there is a series or a sequence of four words, each of which begins with the letter hey. So he challenged them. It's like the Moshe challenge. He says, ask the earlier generations. Do your homework. Ask, did this ever happen? Did this ever happen, something so grand and epic? Hanishmakamo, has anyone even heard about it? Third, Hashama'am kol alukim midaber mitocha eish kasher shamata tava yachid. Did anyone hear Hashem's voice? Hanisa Lukim Lava, Nisa Lukim Lava, Lakachas Lagoy Mikaragoy, is that Kaddish Baruch Hu ever taken a nation from within another nation and marched them across the world to their own homeland? By the way, now he's done it twice. So all of a sudden, you've got this lineup of four hays. Hanihia, Hanishma, Hashama, Hanisa. Did it happen? Did anyone hear about it? Did anyone hear Hashem's voice? Did Hashem ever pull off this miracle? Rashi notices this textual irregularity. He says, "Kol ha'hin," all these hays, halalu, tmiosin. Now, the word tmios means wonder, but it doesn't mean wonder where you're trying to catch someone and contradict. Let me change that word for you and make it more relevant. It doesn't mean wonder, it means the rhetorical astonishment. When there's something that's so spectacular, so mysterious, so beyond, so incomprehensible, but not that you want to solve it, but you realize it's beyond. One of the ways that human beings capture that emotion is to ask a rhetorical question. Very often with a horrible tragedy. How could it happen? The person asking the how is and asking for an answer. Oh, by the way, there was a car crash and the X amount of speed and Y amount of people. It's just, how could something like this happen? And that hey, the rhetorical hey, Hania, Hanishma, Hashama, Hanisa, that's the letter of Jewish history. Because Jewish history is astonishing. Jewish history is baffling. Jewish history is a mystery. Because no one has ever heard the voice of Hashem. Because no other nation has ever, anthropologically, it doesn't happen. Nations secede from host nations and they form a nation of their own right near, right where they live. They don't travel across the world. They don't gather people who have been apart for 2,000 years. They secede and form their own local ethnic nation. That hey, the ha, Hania, Hanishma, Hashama, Hanisa, over Tisha B'Av becomes actually a word that ends with hey, Echa. Echa is the same thing. Echa means how. How? Moshe uses the word Echa. How could the Jews grow so exponentially in the desert? Yeshaya uses the word Echa. How could a people who, we just read it on Shabbos, a people who had established a city of justice, turn that city into a den of iniquity? Yirmiyah uses the word Echa. How could a city that was a thoroughfare for international happenings and events become isolated and alone? Echa Yeshva Badad, which of course we'll read on Tisha B'Av. But what they're all highlighting is that the highs and lows of Jewish history are all disproportionate to the highs and lows of other nations because Jewish history is asymmetrical and disproportionate. And so the word Echa and the Hey in Devarim, so if you're looking for a tie-in between Kriya Satara on Tisha B'Av and Echa, here it is. Moshe uses the word hey. He also used the word Echa, by the way. But when he rifles off these four hays in a row, he's standing and open, gaping in wonder at what has happened to the Jewish people. And he's pleading with them, you're special, you're different. Just appreciate the irrational nature of Jewish history. So that's the second Rashi. A third Rashi, very interesting Rashi. These Rashis are obviously Tisha B'Av related. A third Rashi is where Moshe continues to tell them what Hashem did for them. Pasuk Lamed Zayin. V'tachas ki ahav Hashem es avosecha. Remember the beginning of the pasuk. Hashem loved your parents, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. V'yivchar b'zarach harav, and He chose you as their children, as their descendants. V'yotziacha bifanav. He took you out bifanav, in front of Him. B'chocho agadol mi'mitzrayim. So what does bifanav mean? It's a dangling modifier. Hashem loves your grandparents, your parents, chose you as their children, and He took you out. B'chacho agadol. What is v'yotziacha bifanav? So the Rashi's first pshat is that bifanav refers to Hashem. What does it mean? Well, Rashi means that He held you in front of Him to protect you, like at the Yamsuf. He put you in front of Him, and He buffered between you and the Egyptians. That could be. Could also be a more general bifanav, that we exposed that Kadosh Baruch Hu's Gilui Shechina. Part of Yetzias Mitzrayim was not just the miracles and the logistics and the emancipation and the liberty, but we saw Hashem, we counted Hashem in Mitzrayim, Kechatzot Zaylala Ne'ered Pesach Mitzrayim, as we say the night of Pesach, Be'osos V'mosim, V'yetzeach Hashem Malkein Risham, Be'er Chazaka, V'zroa Neturiyo V'osos V'mosim, and I'm sorry, I missed the word, Be'er Chazaka, V'zroa Neturiyo, So we're exposed to Hashem's Shechina. But what I want to talk about is the second pshat in Rashi. This is Pasuk Lamed Zayin, Perek Dalet. Hashem took you out in front of the avos. And He quotes the Pasuk in Tehillim. In front of the parents, HaKadosh Baruch Hu performed these miracles. Now wait a second. Last I checked, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov had been dead long before. They weren't sitting there watching Yetzias Mitzrayim. The answer was, of course they're watching. They're watching from Shemayim. That's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu begs Moshe to ask the people, to ask the Egyptians, to try to solicit all their funds and all their clothing, because he has an outstanding debt to Avraham. He wants to make sure he's square with Avraham and he does right by Avraham. So we may think that they're buried in their graves, but they're watching what's happening. And of course, it's not important for us to know, for them to be watching. They know they're watching. But for us to know that they're watching, and that we live intergenerationally, and that when major events happen in Jewish history, they're part of it, even though they're long since departed. And when they will long since be departed, but hopefully will be part of that long litany, a long chain of Jewish history and intergenerationality. And it's part of our Tisha B'Av. One of the most poignant kinos we recite on Tisha B'Av begins with Mali Didi Po. And Chazal interpret that through the Medrash, that the night of the Churban, Avraham Avinu starts walking through the Beis HaMikdash, and Hashem says, "What are you here?" And Avraham says, "Well, where are my people?" And there's a conversation that breaks out between Hashem and Avraham Avinu, or there's a scene in another kinah depicted in Shemayim, where the Avos and Imos rise up in mutiny. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, how could this happen? And of course, the only voice that Hashem has to listen to is Rachel because of her heroism, and he assures her, we all know that beautiful kina. So three interesting Rashis. One Rashi about cultural seepage, cultural leaking. If we're in Chutz Laretz and we are subject to the influence of those cultures, and those cultures are infused with theological pagan meaning, then it seeps into us. And that's why the Torah says we're worshiping Avodah Zarah, even though we never really worship them in a ceremonious fashion, in an overt fashion. Number two, Moshe rifles off five hays. Hay is the letter of Jewish history. How could this happen? Eicha, it's the word of Jewish history. Haniyah, the rhetorical, did it ever happen? Hanishma, Hashama. Final Rashi, Votziacha bifanav. Rashi says it refers to the Avos as one unit, one group, Bifanav in front of him, all the seven Avos and Imos, Mitzayach Bifanav, who are watching Yetzias Mitzrayim, who are watching us return to Eretz Yisrael, and who are mourning with us over the next 48 hours.